This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. So under the Trump administration, the Environmental Protection Agency has been dismantling key provisions in rules that former President Obama put into place. It has loosened safety measures on offshore drilling, issued permits for pipelines, and undone emissions regulations for coal plants and cars. And now, the New York Times reports the EPA may change the way it calculates premature deaths attributable to air pollution. And that could pave the way for additional rollbacks on air pollution limits. Drew Schindel is a professor of climate sciences at the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke University. And he's here to help us understand the latest proposed move. Drew, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you.
These are air quality standards. Talk about the standards that are in place now and, you know, tell us what they do and what they're really measuring and telling us about the air and its cleanliness.
Well, we have standards in the U.S. under the Clean Air Act for both suspended particulate and ozone, which are the two main pollutants that cause adverse health impacts. And what we do is look at the medical literature and try to figure out from hospitalization studies and such what is a safe level. Unfortunately, it seems that there's no such thing as a safe level. So in practice, the standards are set to try to protect human health as much as possible, but to really accommodate that we know we're not going to get down to, say, zero exposure.
All right. Suspended particulates. Particulates of what? Suspended where, I guess, in the air? And what do they do to us?
Right. So particulates are the kind of thing that you see, say, pouring out of a diesel bus's smokestack or even tailpipes of cars, factories, etc. The kind you can see are actually fairly big, and so they're not so dangerous. And the ones you worry about are, unfortunately, the ones you can't see, which are so small that when you breathe them in, they penetrate deep down into your lungs, go way down into the body and cause inflammation and stress. And these lead to heart attacks. They lead to lung cancer, they lead to respiratory disease, etc. And so we set limits on the smallest particulates. We set limits on the total amount of them, not based on exactly what they are, but they're things like incompletely burned coal, incompletely burned diesel or gasoline.
All right. And we do a couple of things now, and we should probably, you know, sort of separate these and then find out how they come together to help us create policy. Setting a limit, no more than that. We can't have any more than that number parts per million in the air, okay?
Right.
But then there's the damage they do. And in order for us to understand how they affect our health, we have this ratio about the number of particulates and the number of premature deaths that these particulates would cause at certain levels. So explain the math on that, or explain what it is we're saying when we talk about premature deaths caused by suspended particulates.
Right. So what we do is we look at hospitalization, we look at death certificates, and we correlate those with how much people were exposed. And there's a huge amount of data, actually, from all around the world, from all kinds of different types of experiments, say a small isolated valley where the main pollution source shut off for a year. Well, it's not just the spatial difference, but mostly we look at people's different exposure and see how much more their risk of all of these cardiovascular and respiratory diseases increases. And then we find out, say, it goes up by about 10% per 10 micrograms per cubic meter additional exposure.
And this has a cost on the economy as a whole, a premature death. I mean, again, this is a calculation, but if we lose someone earlier, they've been hospitalized, medicalized, and they've been out of the workforce. Right. And these are some of the costs imposed by these premature deaths.
That's right. And premature deaths is only part of the effect. Of course, people, you know, with chronic diseases are subject to a lot more medical expenses during their life. There's a lot of lost work days. So the whole business community outside the fossil fuel industry is subsidizing the fossil fuel industry. There are lost school days for children. There are lost work days for parents who have to stay home to take care of those children. Right? Children and elderly people are particularly susceptible to particulates and the health impacts that they cause. And so there's a lot of indirect care for elderly and children when they're affected, even beyond those who actually die from this, just people that are rendered sick.
These are costs imposed by the fossil fuel industry that we all pay, that are off of their ledger and that their shareholders don't have to bear. Now, let's talk about then how this, what kind of impact this has with regard to clean air policy. Former President Obama put something into effect called the Clean Power Plant in place. So what does that do?
So the idea of the Clean Power Plan was to both reduce our impact on climate change and improve our air quality in the United States. And that would have imposed stricter regulations on emissions of, again, both the climate-altering and air pollution creating gases and particles. What the current administration has been trying to do is both, as you mentioned, roll back these as well as vehicle and other regulations, but also change the way we do cost-benefit analysis. So they've been trying to say that we should ignore, for example, with climate, any changes beyond our borders. I call this like a kindergarten way of thinking. You know, you're thinking about this is mine rather than share with everybody else, right? We all share the same planet. So in the past, we've always taken into account impacts around the world. So we're trying to reduce the ledger on the benefit side for climate change. And now what they're trying to do is the same kind of thing for air quality. So they're saying that if you go below the limit that has been set by the EPA, which as we just spoke about, is kind of a practical thing that you can achieve, that if you go below that, you wouldn't account for those benefits. Right? So it's another way to weaken the benefits. It's like if you said that, you know, 30,000 people are killed each year in traffic accidents, let's bring that down to 10,000, right? You don't think you can get zero. And then you say, oh, by the way, anything you do for safety that gets you from 10 to, say, 8, that's irrelevant because 10 is the limit, right? Of course it's not irrelevant. We're still saving more people's lives if you get to lower pollution exposure. And they're saying we should ignore that so that the cost benefit looks more attractive to the fossil fuel industry.
So we talk about these changes, the change that would change the calculus here and really basically an amount to another 1,500 deaths per thousand, right? Well, maybe I should ask you to talk about these proposed changes that the New York Times says may be in effect soon.
Right. Well, so the rollback of the rules, the Clean Power Plan, would have saved thousands of Americans' lives every year through reduced pollution exposure. Right? Switching to the Trump administration plan allows a lot of the old coal-fired power plants to keep running, keep polluting, and you don't get that health benefit anymore. The new accounting that they're talking about now says when we decide whether policy is good, you know, naturally we weigh the costs and the benefits, right? We do the pros and cons. So now we're going to put a bunch of the cons off limits, right? The pros for this policy, a bunch of the benefits go off the table. Right? So we're not going to count the health impacts, and therefore it looks like a great policy.
The change would result in 1,400 premature deaths, an additional 1,400 premature deaths per year, but as you say, because it's below this threshold. So somebody, I heard it explained, I think you used traffic as an example. You set the speed limit at 65 miles an hour, and that's because you think this is the safe highest speed you can go to be safe on this. That doesn't mean there are no deaths at 55 miles an hour. That doesn't mean that accidents don't happen at 45 miles an hour and that nobody can die at that rate. But here's what William Wareham says. He's the EPA Assistant Administrator for Air Quality, also a former lobbyist for the chemical industry. But he says, look, how in the world can you get $30 or $40 billion of benefit to public health when most of it is attributable to reductions in areas that have already met the standard?
Right. Well, so you're saying, again, just like we've been talking about, that since the EPA has declared that this level is safe, right, that therefore there's no benefit below it. But really, the logic is kind of spun on its head, because really what we know from the medical studies is that there is a benefit. And so the logical thing to do would say, hey, maybe we should stop calling that safe, but actually push for a lower limit, rather than saying there's an arbitrary definition that says this is probably a good level, so we'll ignore anything below it, even though all of the evidence says that these are real benefits.
And possibly 1,400 premature deaths would add up to $30 or $40 billion. We don't know. And so it's amazing to think about how, again, the sort of math in this. We have had bipartisan support for things like the Clean Air Act, which was passed in 1970 for a long time. And it was really based on, it seems to me, the bipartisan support, the fact that we understood that these costs would be recouped. I wonder if that's changing, the idea that clean air actually has an economic benefit beyond the health benefit, and it always has.
Well, I think there's been an enormous shift, and we did, as you said, have enormous bipartisan levels of support for environmental regulations back in the 1970s. And during the last 20 years, it's shifted to be almost completely divided along party lines. And one of the real reasons is when you look at these policies, you see that they're designed now to benefit the fossil fuel industry at the expense of the general population. And so ever since Citizens United changed the way we fund our political campaigns, the fossil fuel industry's contributions have shifted almost entirely to the Republican Party, and they have shifted almost perfectly into lockstep with their positions.
Now, what about these standards? Let's talk about those, though, because they've been in place for a while. Do they get reviewed periodically? It does seem like it's obviously based on evidence, but we've got a lot of averages on averages on averages. How often are they reviewed, and how much refining do you think could be used?
The standards are reviewed periodically by an expert panel assembled by the US EPA. There are similar standards set around the world, so this is not done in a vacuum. The World Health Organization sets these, all the European countries, Japan, et cetera. And so we all have access to the same scientific literature. The same peer-reviewed papers come out. We generally find that as our evidence improves, we find things like their sensitivity to pollution at lower and lower levels, which we weren't able to measure before. So we do generally tighten the standards. It's very seldom that they end up being weakened. It's very useful to review them. It generally, after several decades of standard making, the changes tend to be fairly small.
We are talking today to Drew Schindel, who's a professor of climate sciences at the Nicholas School of Environment at Duke University. Drew, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on The State of Things is a play in Durham probing questions about art and identity. We'll talk about them on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us.